S list had already climbed north of 400. Kasson's nights were devoted to drop-bys at a blur of agency, advertiser, and media parties. After leaving the Omnicom, Havas, and then MediaVest parties Tuesday evening, he raced by foot to the XS nightclub in the Encore Hotel for MediaLink's cocktail party. Coming toward him was an elderly man and a younger blonde, holding hands and wearing matching black sneakers. It was Rupert Murdoch, who Kasson says is his biggest client, and Jerry Hall, soon to be his wife. After a warm exchange of hellos, Kasson quickened his pace and soon was escorted past long lines into the XS nightclub for what was billed as the MediaLink party. Like Kasson, Carolyn Everson of Facebook had a packed schedule at CES. While being ferried in a black SUV to one of her many appointments in Las Vegas, she said of CES, "People moan and groan that it's the first thing they have to do when they come back from holiday. We all do it." And yet every top marketer and agency and media and technology company is here. Her Facebook team scheduled 122 meetings this week, 30 of which she would attend. They reviewed with brands what they did together in 2015 and what the new challenges for 2016 were. Her task, as she saw it, was to help galvanize the marketing world to address disruption. Her pitch in meetings here, she says, goes like this. The real challenge in the industry today is that consumer behavior has shifted already. More time is spent on mobile apps than on television. However, mobile is still an afterthought for most marketing campaigns. Companies are struggling with how to rejigger their teams, their skills, their workflow, their board structure, so they can be more relevant to consumers in a mobile environment. The real question is, how fast can they do that? Companies that have been around for 100-plus years? Really hard to change behavior and culture. New companies, they go right to mobile. Do you think Uber is worried about anything other than the experience on the mobile device? By selling mobile, she knows she is selling Facebook. But here, as elsewhere, she is both a self-serving and a supportive missionary. She knows companies will not shift to mobile unless they first transform their culture. How can we help them learn from what Facebook is doing to hire people that are focused on impact, that are willing to move quickly, that are willing to have failures? To prod them, I start off by showing the big photo of Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park, which has the big like sign. Facebook's sprawling headquarters was once home to Sun Microsystems, a seemingly impregnable tech company that fizzled and was sold to Oracle in 2009. She tells them what they don't see on the face of the like sign. If you peek behind the sign, you will see the old Sun Microsystems sign. They say, why? Because every time a Facebook employee leaves campus, we want them to remember that at any moment, you could become irrelevant. Sun was an amazing company, and now they're no longer here. One of the oddities of CES is that most marketers don't actually visit the exhibits. No one wants to go to the floor, Andrew Markowitz, GE's director of global digital strategy, said during a MediaLink panel on brand reinvention. They want to be here for face-to-face meetings. There's a ton of meetings going on. And when people visit the exhibits, strange things can happen. The 6,000 journalists who attend CES are asked to share their email addresses, prompting a deluge of invitations to visit some pretty flaky-sounding exhibits. Like the invite from Pet Chats, which was described as the first-ever technology that lets dogs and cats call their owners for a video chat and treat, and lets owners call their pets while away. The email invite said Pet Chats was located in CES booth 82646, which was in Hall G of the Sands. But a trip to the floor found booth 82646 empty. One objective of CES is to manufacture buzz. In 2016, virtual reality was the much-hyped new thing, which would be supplanted at CES 2017 by artificial intelligence, and AI-centric products like self-driving cars and Amazon's Alexa. In previous years, drones, Google Glass, and 4K TVs had their moment. Writing about CES 2016, Farhad Manju of the New York Times observed, "If news from CES feels especially desultory this year, it might not be the show that's at fault. Instead, blame the tech cycle. We're at a weird moment in the industry. The best new stuff is not all that cool. And the coolest stuff, AI, virtual reality, the Internet of Things, drones, isn't quite ready." If CES had been a warm bath of relationship building, the American Association of Advertising Agencies conference at the Lowe's Miami Beach Hotel, 2 months later, centered more on conflict. The much-anticipated ANA report on agency kickbacks, sparked by John Mandel's speech a year earlier, hovered over anxious agency executives. Michael Kasson spoke of the K2 Ubiquity investigation for the ANA and evoked a common fear. We're weeks away from Armageddon. The information he had picked up was that the report would be damning, and though it would not cite agencies by name, he guessed that clients would then launch more audits of their agencies and maybe even ask, "Do I really need an agency?" One source who was said to be familiar with the report's conclusions even went so far as to tell Business Insider that some agency executives might face jail time. Erwin Gottlieb was alert to the report, but less alarmist. He said he had heard various versions of what the report would say and expected it would be harsh. "It's being driven by ubiquity," he said. "They want more business. They have a great deal to gain by fomenting distrust between clients and agencies. They want to get clients to hire them to monitor agencies." On the eve of the 4A's annual March conference, war had broken out between the organization representing agencies and the organization representing advertisers. The joint task force the two organizations established after Mandel's speech, with the aim of agreeing to transparency principles, had ended in bitterness and recrimination. ANA board member Jack Haber says, "The 4As said, 'We're not going to cooperate with you unless you do it our way.'" He says the 4As would agree to transparency principles for agencies, but not for the worldwide holding companies. "We said, no go." Then they issued it themselves. Haber says he hoped both sides could take it down from an emotional pitched battle. But for him and the ANA, the core question was simple. Are you my agent or not? Nancy Hill, the president and CEO of the 4As, saw it differently. After working together for 9 months to draft transparency guidelines, she said the task force splintered just before Christmas because the ANA suddenly wanted to make a rash of changes to the document. They wanted to dictate contract language to an entire industry, while the 4As believed contracts should be negotiated between individual clients and agencies. By toughening the language in the draft, agency reps believed, ANA members were behaving like cowardly politicians afraid to look weak to their foremost constituency, their CEO and chief procurement officer. As a counter, the 4As rushed to release its own transparency principles. On the surface, the 4As Miami conference seemed like business as usual. The agenda was billed as Transformation 2016. MediaLink co-hosted an opening night after party at a nearby hotel. A familiar array of speakers, Maurice Levy, Martin Sorrell, Wendy Clark, Bill Konigsberg, Jeff Goodby, Carolyn Everson, Rashad Tabakawala, and Rob Norman appeared. There would be panels on how to drive business results with engaging digital content, how agencies can attract top talent, the future of the industry, the future of news, and the state of programmatic advertising. And, of course, there would be awards. As at most industry conferences, Michael Kasson would be spotted one moment in a choice seat at the chairman's table in front of the stage checking emails, the next moment walking about exchanging hugs with old friends, or slipping outside the ballroom to speak on his mobile, or surrounded by people enjoying his jokes. What wasn't typical was the tension. It wasn't just the pending ANA report. Many delegates arrived on edge because of an ugly and well-publicized sexual harassment lawsuit filed just days earlier by J. Walter Thompson's communication chief, Aaron Johnson, against her boss, global CEO Gustavo Martinez. Johnson's court papers claimed Martinez subjected her and other employees to an unending stream of racist and sexist comments, as well as unwanted touching and other unlawful conduct. Once, she said, he approached her desk and told her to follow him so he could rape her in the bathroom. Another time, he allegedly interrupted a meeting with 60 employees, including females, to ask Johnson which female staff member he could rape. She alleged that he described African Americans as black monkeys and apes, and said he and his wife disliked living in Westchester County because he hates those fucking Jews. Johnson said she complained to various officials at J. Walter Thompson and parent company WPP, and they either excused his behavior, assured her they would talk to him and didn't, or cautioned, "Don't harm your career." Martinez issued a public statement flatly declaring, "There is absolutely no truth to these outlandish allegations, and I am confident that this will be proven in court." WPP initially issued a statement saying an internal investigation found no evidence that Johnson's claims were true. The company placed her on paid leave while Martinez continued as CEO. Days later, WPP announced it had hired a law firm to investigate. On the eve of the conference, Martinez withdrew from appearing on a 4A's panel and, by mutual agreement, stepped down as CEO and was replaced by Tamara Ingram, a seasoned WPP executive. Over coming months, WPP was assailed by Johnson's lawyers for opposing the lawsuit and for implicitly defending Martinez. Asked whether WPP was complicit, Martin Sorrell said WPP had offered Johnson another job and continued to pay her. As for Martinez, he said, "You don't try people in the court of public opinion." WPP attempted to have the lawsuit dismissed, and in December 2016, the court ruled against them. In December 2017, the case was still alive, and, despite the sexual harassment claims, it was revealed that WPP placed Martinez in charge of its operations in his native country, Spain. Aaron Johnson did not attend the conference, but her story certainly did. It brought back memories. In Mad Men days at J. Walter Thompson, bathroom signs bellowed, "Gentlemen." Women found their bathrooms behind unmarked doors. When Marion Harper, the CEO of IPG, in 1966 offered Mary Wells Lawrence a promotion and the salary and authority of the president of Jack Tinker and Partners, he said he couldn't offer her the title. "It is not my fault, Mary. The world is not ready for women presidents." She promptly quit. More recently, the 3% Conference, which promotes female creative agency leadership, reported that although women comprise half of agency employees, only 11% of creative directors are female, and less than 1% of marketing executives were black women. Reflecting a common perception among women in advertising, one hears complaints about the social activities that male colleagues organize. Golf outings, watching sporting events like football, steak dinners, that make them feel like outsiders. "I don't want to whine, 'Oh, poor me.' That's wasted energy," Wendy Clark said, before going to Miami, recalling that several years ago when she joined a new company that she declined to name, "In my executive package, I was referred to as an employee, and my husband was a trailing spouse. He has an MBA, and he looked at me and said, 'Really? I'm a trailing spouse?'" She laughs, knowing the employment forms were created by men who assumed that women trail men. The frustration of female executives spilled out at the 4A's. In her welcoming remarks to open the conference, Nancy Hill, whose career was in advertising, immediately raised the case of Aaron Johnson. Unfortunately, the alleged behavior does happen. And it happens more frequently than we think. She pleaded for a very frank conversation about sexual harassment in the industry. Real change, she insisted, has to start at the top. In an address minutes later, Wendy Clark kept the sexual harassment issue alive by declaring, "Fundamentally, we have to pull back the curtain on this discussion and as an industry use confabs like this to share our best thinking and best ideas." In a fireside chat on the second day, Carolyn Everson was asked how the industry was doing in regard to gender equality. "I don't think we're in a good place at all," she answered, citing as evidence, "There's not a single country in the world where more than 6% of their CEOs are women. The needle hasn't moved." Choking back tears on one panel and sparking a rousing ovation, Chloe Gottlieb, Senior Vice President and Creative Director at RGA, chastised her industry. "Where are the people of color? We're a white industry." Also, a white male-dominated industry. Business Insider released a report on the 16 highest compensated, salary, stock options, and other incentives, advertising executives in 2015, and all 16 were white males. Topping the list were three holding company CEOs: Martin Sorrell, $87,500,000, John Wren, $23,576,047, and Michael Roth, $14,458,102, with Maurice Levy, $2,900,000, falling closer to the bottom of the list. When Maurice Levy was the keynote speaker the first morning, he and Martin Sorrell wound up trading insults. For those who have long followed their clashes, the feud between the diminutive British bulldog and the tall, elegant Frenchman with a full head of wavy gray hair brings to mind Donald Trump's tweets. Neither Sorrell nor Levy can resist the pleasure of inflicting pain on a perceived enemy. Their clash at the forays concerned the allegations of sexual harassment at WPP. The Gustavo Martinez incident and Aaron Johnson's lawsuit arose when Maurice Levy spoke. He did not attack WPP. Rather, he told the audience he did not believe the alleged extreme behavior of Martinez was typical. "It's a one-time mistake, a huge fault, but it's not a fair representation of our industry." Levy was not challenging the claims made by many female speakers at this forays that the industry lacked diversity, that it was guilty of offering too few opportunities to women, and had succumbed to what Carolyn Everson of Facebook would later tell the audience was unconscious bias. He was simply claiming that Martinez's alleged extreme behavior was not the norm. The next day, Sorrell appeared via a video hookup for an interview and deftly changed the subject from the behavior of the J. Walter Thompson CEO to Levy's behavior. "He violently disagreed with Levy," he said. "Maurice has a habit of ignoring the facts and getting to his opinions." This was among the milder things Sorrell has said about Levy. When asked about Sorrell after the forays, at first Levy said he did not wish to offer a description, and added falsely that in the past, when he has offered criticism of Sorrell, it was always in reaction, unfortunately. What was the crux of the problem between them? "You should ask Martin." He paused as if he would say no more, but he could not contain himself. "I think the problem he has, besides the fact that I am twice as tall as he is, I think there is a problem with competition. There are two brands in the advertising industry, Sorrell and Levy. Besides," he added several sentences later, "he doesn't like the French. He considers that we are second-class citizens." Levy traces their bad blood back to their competition to buy Young and Rubicam in 1999, and then in 2003, the British agency, Cordiant. A fair amount of rage and gloom was expressed throughout the conference. The chairman of the forays, Bill Konigsberg, stunned conferees with his opening remarks when he said, "I'm pissed off." What angered him is something that has long infuriated agencies. Clients induce agencies to make free spec pitches during agency reviews, which burden agencies with about $400 million in free employee hours. "Our product is being devalued. We have to stop the insanity of giving away our work for free." On a panel with Vice co-founder and CEO Shane Smith, New York Times CEO Mark Thompson borrowed from Game of Thrones and predicted that winter was coming for the advertising industry. Smith chimed in, "You're going to see a bloodbath of consolidation in the industry." In a talk on making advertising matter again, Jeff Goodby, co-founder and co-chair of Goodby Silverstein & Partners, talked about some of the ad campaigns he crafted, not including the one he would do pro bono against Donald Trump's candidacy for president. The Trump ad featured video of proud moments in American history, landing a man on the moon, inventing rock and roll and the internet, and closed by saying that we didn't do all this just to be laughed at by the entire world in November. The ad closed with a close-up of Trump's face, and in large text, the words, "History is watching." Goodby appeared in a black jacket and black mock turtleneck, with a long silver ponytail sliding down his back, and made a declaration creatives have made for decades. The only way to save advertising from low morale and from 70% of employees seeking new jobs was to re-inject enthusiasm into the business by regaining a sense of creative vandalism. He explained, "Like good advertising, good vandalism is funny, loud, and still there the next day." In the Truth About Talent panel, a LinkedIn senior director, Jan Schwartz, who is their liaison to the giant holding companies, recounted the results of a joint study with the 4As to explore the reasons professionals fled agency jobs. The survey sample was large, consisting of 300,000 professionals worldwide and 10,000 professionals who had switched jobs. While the foremost reason cited for leaving agencies was lack of opportunities to advance and a desire for more challenging work, the survey also noted that the average first-year agency salary is $45,000 less than in the technology sector. The median salaries for copywriters, $51,030, account executives, $45,338, or art directors, $56,263, ranked near the bottom among industries. The average starting salary at ad agencies, $25,000, was almost three times below that of management consultants, $70,000. Of college grads, 31-year-old Rob Fishman, the co-founder of Niche, which recruits influencers to promote brands on digital sites, would say before the conference, "I don't know a single person who wants to work in an ad agency. It's not like it was in Don Draper's day." Indeed. A study under the direction of Scott Galloway, a marketing professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, reported that 2,227 of WPP's employees left to go to work for Google and Facebook, and only 124 joined WPP from the tech giants. "The ad world today is increasingly run by the leftovers," Galloway writes in his 2017 book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. WPP disputed his facts, saying their data revealed that only 200 left for Google and Facebook in the past year and a half, and about 70 joined WPP. Another panel, The Future of the Industry, Rashad Tabakawala of Publicis, Rob Norman of Group M, and Scott Hagedorn, then CEO of Analect, tried to inject some optimism into the proceedings. "We have a front row seat at the nexus of disruption, which creates opportunities," Norman said. "The future is likely to be far brighter than the past," said Tabakawala, emphasizing that with the advent of digital and a proliferation of competing platforms, marketing opportunities will rise as traditional advertising declines. "We have to stop being insecure." "There's no better time to be in this business," said Norman, mentioning the knowledge their global businesses could glean from the rise of video versus television in China. The different marketing successes in India, like P&G's Ariel detergent campaign, the e-commerce lessons taught by Amazon, which boosted sales by offering free delivery and streaming TV and movies for an annual subscription to Amazon Prime. When asked why advertising did not seem to work in the Republican primaries despite huge TV expenditures by candidates like Jeb Bush, Norman, as marketers are apt to do, turned that negative into a positive. If you have any doubt about the power of branded content, think of The Apprentice. 14. The client jury reaches its verdict. A K2 investigator said he thought the rebates could be classified as civil or criminal fraud because publicly traded companies are required to disclose their finances, and they didn't. It was a few days before the long-awaited ANA report was to be released on June 7, 2016, and Michael Kassin remained convinced its conclusions would be devastating for the giant holding companies, who he thought were in denial as to the seriousness of the claims against them. He had made a bid to conduct the investigation, seemingly unmindful that he would be investigating many of his own clients. In hindsight, he realized he had been lucky to be passed over to conduct the ANA probe. Had he been awarded the contract, he would not have been able to accept the new clients clamoring for MediaLink to review their agency contracts. He was also aware that the sleuthing work would inevitably strain relations with his friends, especially with Erwin Gottlieb. Kassin was right about the report's harsh conclusions. After conducting 143 interviews and inspecting emails and other documents over 8 months, the core conclusion of the 58-page K2 report was that there is a fundamental disconnect in the advertising industry regarding the basic nature of the advertising agency relationship. Advertisers believed that their agencies were duty-bound to act in their best interest. They also believed that this obligation, essentially in their view a fiduciary duty, extends beyond the stated terms in their agency contracts. In this expansive view, the agency was an agent of the client. The narrower contractual view publicly proclaimed by Erwin Gottlieb and shared by many agency executives, the report said, was that their relationship to advertisers was solely defined by the contract between the two parties. The report affirmed the broad charges lodged by John Mandel. Rebates were common in the United States, the report concluded. K2 interviewed 41 sources who reported that media rebate deals occur in the U.S. market. Of the 41 sources, 34 said the rebate information and monies were not shared with advertisers. Media companies who sold the ads secretly kicked back to agencies between 1.67% to approximately 20% of aggregate media spending, depending on the deal. The rebates took different forms, from cash to free ad inventory to debt forgiveness to benefits like equity in the media company. The most common way the rebate system worked, said the report, is that the agency holding companies used their purchasing power to buy discounted advertising time, which they then resold at a higher rate to their individual agencies, who buy this ad time for clients. The lower purchase price paid by the holding company was not disclosed to the client. The report also said that holding companies often directed that ad dollars be shoveled to media companies they partially owned. This served the interests of the holding company, but these ad platforms were often extraneous to the client. This would not be the first time a holding company was called out for extracting rebates. In 2008, the Securities and Exchange Commission imposed a $12 million settlement on IPG for rebates its McCann-Erickson agency demanded in violation of its contracts with clients. Nor would it be the last. 2 months after the ANA report, The Guardian in England disclosed that it pays rebates to agencies, including free advertising space, cash payments, or both. And in September 2016, a scandal surfaced in Japan when an important client, Toyota, complained that Japanese advertising giant Dentsu falsely billed them for digital ads that did not appear. After an audit, an embarrassed Dentsu announced that it would repay 111 advertisers a total of 230 million yen, roughly $200 million. The report acknowledged the fairness of complaints agencies often lodge against clients. In new business pitches by agencies, the report said, clients were too often preoccupied, not with marketing strategy or fresh creative ideas, but with the agency's fees. The rise of procurement officers, the report conceded, meant constant cost pressures, since marketing was usually viewed as a cost, not an investment. And with the end of the commission system, agencies sometimes struggled to make money. Clients were often guilty of not auditing their contracts to learn if agencies were in compliance. And ANA President Bob Leides admitted that his client constituents were often asleep when it came to rigorous audits and contracts, conceding that the behavior on the client side was a little more paralyzed than one would have liked. But the thrust of the report was a clear condemnation of the agencies. They were found guilty of engaging in secret rebates, of acting in their interests, not the interests of their clients, and of a basic lack of transparency. Of the six holding companies, the report said they interviewed executives at all six, but that only IPG officially cooperated. The ANA emphasized the trust issue. Advertisers and their agencies are lacking full disclosure as the cornerstone principle of their media management practices, Leides said in a prepared statement. Such disclosure is absolutely essential if they are to build trust as the foundation of their relationships with their long-term partners. The report, Leides declared at a press briefing, represents an opportunity to rebuild agency-client trust. He promised that by July, the second company involved in the investigation, Ebiquity, would release transparency principles for his 700 members. The ANA urged its membership to re-examine all its agency contracts. Requesting anonymity, a K2 executive was harsh, saying he thought the rebates could be classified as civil or criminal fraud. In addition, publicly traded companies are required to disclose their finances, and they didn't. There are a number of different angles a regulator or a prosecutor could use as a hook. The report was vulnerable to criticism. Because no guilty agencies were identified by name, and because the charges were anonymous, K2 found substantial evidence of non-transparent business practices in agency holding companies, as well as in certain independent agencies. All but the smallest agencies were tarred with this broad brush. The name no names approach was promulgated by the ANA, as the report says. From the outset, the ANA made clear to K2 that the goal of the study was not to embarrass or accuse any individual or corporate entity of malfeasance. Instead of singling out this or that agency for malfeasance, the report leaves the impression that all, or at least most, agencies are miscreants. Since the report fails to name client victims, all clients are left to wonder whether they might be victims. The agencies were livid. In a public statement, the 4As denounced the report, saying it is anonymous and one-sided and paints the entire industry with the same negative brush. They bridled that the ANA was treating their agency partners as targets of an investigation, even though the introduction to the report repeatedly claimed this was a study, not an investigation. Yet when asked whether his failure to name names slandered innocent agencies, former federal prosecutor and principal author of the report, Richard Plansky, described his work as an investigation. "I don't think that's a valid criticism. When you do an investigation and sources are at risk, it is standard industry practice to grant them confidentiality." Attorneys for WPP and Omnicom had their law firms dispatch letters to the ANA demanding proof that they extracted rebates. Each holding company denied they pocketed rebates in the United States. Martin Sorrell and Erwin Gottlieb publicly questioned the motives of K2 and Ebiquity, charging that both firms had an axe to grind because they were angling to become the go-to auditors for advertisers. Erwin Gottlieb went further, questioning the assumption animating the ANA report that agencies are agents for their clients. Gottlieb measures his words carefully, and his answers to questions arrive as if in slow motion. In his office, he was asked, "Does Group M receive rebates in North America?" He waited seconds to answer before stating flatly, "Zero rebates in North America." There followed another long pause before he continued, "We've been very clear. We are not an agency. If they were not an agent of the client, he was asked, were they a partner? I wish we were a partner. Ad agencies, when they were formed, acted like the seller's agent, not the buyer's agent. Look at who paid the commission. It was the seller. Somehow it evolved into a relationship where there was an assumed fiduciary responsibility to the client. However, contractual terms that have come into common practice, particularly over the last dozen years or so, are the kinds of terms that can't be reconciled with an agent-type relationship. I will give you three examples. An agent can't be held to deliver specific costs per thousands. Clients often ask us to provide guarantees and to put our fees at risk. It's become common practice. Second, agents don't offer extended payment terms, meaning they will not get paid for months, which are now routinely demanded by clients. We're not a bank. Third, agents aren't asked to indemnify clients for IP violations on technology. We're not an insurance company. Feeling pressured by clients to reduce their fees and pressured by their holding companies to produce profit margins approaching 20% and increasingly vexed by insecure relationships with clients, agencies don't feel as if they have signed a marriage vow. This is one big takeaway from the ANA report. Agency and client often don't share a common definition of their role, and thus mistrust arises. When agencies aggressively seek new ways to generate income, like employing their own funds to gamble on buying ad time and later selling it at a higher rate, they think they are serving their fiduciary responsibility to shareholders. Clients think of them as unfaithful. Clients say agencies are taking rebates that deprive them of money. Holding companies say they are taking risks with their own money and being rewarded for it. The drive by holding companies to tap new revenue streams serves as evidence to clients that the agency has mistresses. When Dave Morgan of Simul Media looks at how agencies, backed by the 4As, insist that in the new world they must be allowed to trade on their own behalf and maintain undisclosable deals with media suppliers, he concludes that this translates to rebates. It's pretty clear that the parsing of language became a big issue in the allegations and denials of rebate activities in North America. Not unlike, I didn't inhale. After reading the report, Rashad Tabakawala of Publicis came away with two opposite conclusions. Agencies are at fault, he says. There's a lot of truth in that report. We're trying to sell all the time. We don't listen enough to our clients. We have to help our clients prosper. Yet the ANA report is the biggest mass suicide of CMOs. The ANA hired the hitman who, in hitting the agencies, also hit them by making them look like they did not understand the space or how to steward the money. The report helps give power to the CFOs and procurement officers, which spreads more distrust between client and agency. By mid-2017, there was scant evidence that as a result of the report, clients had reduced their ad spending with agencies, or whisked their business from the large holding companies to flee to smaller independent agencies. Agency executives, in effect, boasted, "Look, there have been no indictments or charges filed against any of us." However, what is clear is that the ANA report has had a poisonous impact on the trust client and agency require to partner. Clients are wary, often maintaining more of an arm's-length relationship with their agencies. And many agency executives are dispirited. We've been assaulted in the trade publications as crooks with no let-up, says a senior agency official who does not want to be named. By the way, your family reads this stuff too. There was one other clear outcome. Once again, the report meant more business for Michael Kasson and MediaLink. 15. Khan takes center stage. MediaLink is the embodiment of one zealous man's unwillingness to say no. Michael built a giant dating service between circles that don't know how to talk to one another. he connected all these pieces. He has a rare ability to create a prom that everyone wants to be at. Digitas CEO Tony Weissman. As his car inched along in clotted Cannes traffic, Michael Kassin's 4 smartphones vibrated relentlessly, a flurry of calls and emails pleading for a few extra invites to his annual dinner at the world's foremost advertising conference, the Cannes Lions Festival. Already, he had approved 400 media and marketing executive invitations to the exclusive June 2016 event he and MediaLink host at the Hotel du Cap, and some 500 more people were clamoring to squeeze in. He had carefully added attendees to the $400,000 dinner from the cream of his media and platform client list, including NBC Universal, Microsoft, The New York Times, The Walt Disney Company, 21st Century Fox, Facebook, Google, Twitter, Condé Nast, Hearst, Dow Jones, The New York Post, The Washington Post, Gannett, iHeartMedia, Viacom, Turner Broadcasting, Bloomberg, Flipboard, and Vox Media. He had included the holding company executives, who often have a love-hate relationship with Kassin, wanting his favor, yet fearing he might whisper to his brand clients they should move to a new agency. Brand clients like Unilever, AT&T, Verizon, L'Oreal, Bank of America, Colgate, and American Express were, of course, also invited. No other gathering during June's week-long festival, not those hosted by Facebook or Google with libations on the beach, or WPP's afternoon buffet and stream conference on the adjacent island of Île Saint-Honorat, or even a luncheon invite from Rupert Murdoch, is more coveted. As usual, in Cannes, MediaLink was performing a role that was a cross between curator and concierge. It dispatched a total of 45 staffers to service 91 attending clients and participate in over 700 matchmaker meetings over the course of the week, not counting the onstage speeches and panels MediaLink arranged for clients. Each staffer organized about 6 meetings per client. Scott Goodman, the MediaLink vice president in charge of coordinating staff assignments, said most media clients first requested meetings with prospective advertisers, and then with agencies. "The event itself is the easy part," Goodman said. "Even if you're the best wedding planner, the wedding itself is easy. What's hard are the months of planning." Michael Kassin's ready smile camouflaged the stress he felt in Cannes. "Just imagine," he said as the chauffeured car headed to a dinner. "For 5 days at the end of June in a 4-block radius on the Côte d'Azur, 100% of my revenue is there. Virtually every client is represented there. Here's the Wall Street Journal. Am I going to turn down Dow Jones? I'm going to say, you can have 4 dinner invites. You can't have 7. An email beeps from Revlon owner Ron Perelman, asking to bring all the guests on his yacht. "No," Kassin dictates to his chief of staff, Martin Rothman, seated in the front seat. Beep. An email from a CEO at one of the companies that reports to his friend Bob Pittman's iHeartMedia, the powerful radio station owner who provides the dinner's entertainment. Pittman induced Chris Martin of Coldplay to perform this year, as he induced Sting in 2015, Mariah Carey in 2014, and Elton John in 2013. The iHeart executive asks for an additional 5 dinner invites. Kassin has a sly solution. "This is like when my son got married to the daughter of our best friends, and we were making the wedding list, and someone was friends with both sides. I said, 'This is on your fucking list.' Am I going to be the guy who tells him no? I'm going to have Bob tell him no." His chief of staff makes a note. In Cannes, too, Kassin is a celebrity. He gets the Choice Hollywood Star-named suites. Sean Connery, Sophia Loren, Cary Grant, renamed the Liu Yi Suite, at the festival's Ground Zero, the Carlton Hotel. He knows the names and embraces most folks who say hello or seek a private word. He slips from one meeting or panel to another, rarely staying long, but always able to boast that he was there. Maitre D's bow as he calls out their first names, no doubt remembering the many times he has generously smeared them. After hosting a cocktail party Tuesday night, Kasson turned to his chief of staff and asked Martin Rothman to book a table at the Le Machu restaurant. Although a long line in front of the restaurant snaked a good distance down the cobblestone hill, Kasson was immediately escorted to Le Machu's exclusive outpost directly across the narrow street, where his party of three dined alone in a space that could accommodate maybe 10. Tony Weissman, then the CEO of Digitas, which retains MediaLink to arrange meetings, speeches, and panels at industry events like Cannes, marvels at a feat Kasson pulled off here. Viacom was a client, and its CEO, Philippe Domon, was on the cusp of getting fired, his cable ratings plummeting, his pay climbing to $54 million in 2015 as his stock dropped like a rock. Domon would host a dinner Thursday, and he tasked Kasson with producing an A-list of guests. I would love to know what Philippe Domon pays Michael to get the four holding company CEOs to attend his dinner, Weissman said. One lure to attend was the reality TV equivalent of watching how Domon handled his pending corporate death. Weissman salutes Kasson and MediaLink. They do not have a competitor. MediaLink is the embodiment of one zealous man's unwillingness to say no. Michael built a giant dating service between circles that don't know how to talk to one another. Brand clients like Unilever and AT&T, which in the past did not have to think about new ad tech or digital companies like Facebook, and publishers like Condé Nast or Hearst, which didn't have to worry about knowing the brands because the brands sought their platforms, were suddenly at sea. He connected all these pieces. He has a rare ability to create a prom that everyone wants to be at. The Lions Festival was launched in Venice in 1954, alternating between several cities, including Cannes, before making Cannes its official home in 1984. Initially, it was naturally dominated by the creative agencies. Philip Thomas, who was the CEO of the Cannes Lions before being promoted to CEO of Essential Events by its corporate parent in 2017, remembers that in 2003, Jim Stengel, then CMO of Procter & Gamble, was the first client to make a point of attending, and this represented a big, big shift. That attracted more of the media agencies. Today, Thomas says, clients comprise one quarter of all attendees. Next came the digital companies, then the media and publishing platforms, and most recently, the consulting and software companies. A breakthrough in getting celebrities to attend and bulking the press contingent up to 600, he says, was the arrival in 2014 of Kim Kardashian. The Mail Online were very, very clever. They took a yacht at our festival and invited her. It was the same year that the festival invited her husband, Kanye West, to appear. The Mail got blanket coverage, providing an incentive for celebrities to flock to the festival. Hoping for buzz, more companies hired yachts or gave opulent beach parties and invited celebrities. Some old-timers, like Bob Greenberg of RGA, are devoted to Cannes. RGA brings 30 executives. I go and I come back and I can see patterns, he says, whether it is glimpsing the disruptive power of WeChat in China or digesting the creative work of competitors. Not all of his creative colleagues are as enamored. Jeff Goodby, who was anointed president of the festival in 2002 and head of the prestigious Titanium Jury in 2006, is troubled by what he sees as a diminution of attention for creative advertising. It's about making money. It changes everything, he says. It changes the festival, he has written, into a plumber's or industrial roofing convention, after which I go home and begin to explain to a friend that there is an amazing new fiberglass insulation technology. The Cannes Festival is owned by Essential Holdings, a company based in the UK that organizes festivals and exhibitions and provides economic information and analysis for clients around the world. The Lions Festival is a lucrative business. Each of the 15,000 delegates who attended paid as much as 3,750 euros, approximately $4,400, for the full 8 days with line-skipping privileges, or a somewhat lesser amount for fewer days and perks, down to 895 euros for students and professionals under 30. Each agency from the 110 countries that attends and submits creative entries in one of the 24 Lions Awards categories pays an average of 500 euros for most entries, rising to 1,399 euros for the most prestigious prize, the Titanium Lions. In 2016, there were 43,101 submissions and 1,360 Lions Awards presented. If only four awards were given in each of the 24 categories, Grand Prix, Gold, Silver, and Bronze, the total number of winners would be only 96. Khan inflated the number of winners by giving multiple prizes for each category. A third Lion's source of revenue comes from its 400 event sponsors, who, Thomas says, pay from $20,000 to $700,000. This includes the cost to Samsung of its virtual reality exhibit, and the total of $300,000 for MediaLink sponsorship, and two large LED electronic screens on the lawn outside the Carlton Hotel, which clients like the New York Times and the Washington Post subsidize to carry their news flashes and promos. Other revenues sprout from its archive of speeches and talks and ad campaigns presented at the festival or at its three regional festivals. For 18,000 euros, 20 employees in a company get digital access for 1 year to 270,000 ad campaigns and 450 hours of talks. Yachts receive a parking spot in the harbor, plus five festival passes for $22,715. In all, the 2016 festival hauled in $62.5 million for Essential. Attendance is pricey, and not just because a Black Angus Chateaubriand in the Hotel Martinez costs $161, and Delta raised its round-trip first-class nonstop New York to Nice flight from $5,332 to $12,069. In addition to the attendance fee, MediaLink pays for its 45 staffers' airfare, hotels, and food, plus the Hotel du Cap dinner they host, plus the separate Cassin-hosted Boys Night Out, sponsored and mostly paid for this year by Hulu, and the Millard-hosted Girls Night Out party, co-hosted by Facebook and iHeartMedia. The cost to holding companies like WPP and Publicis works out to about $20,000 per employee. WPP had 1,000 employees attend in 2016. The awards are especially prized. Awards fulfill a function in our industry, Philip Thomas says. Since choosing winners is subjective, the only way to prove you're creative is the external acknowledgement of an award. Bob Greenberg's loft-like RGA offices at 10th Avenue and West 33rd Street contains a shrine of six walls of trophies and plaques, including the 33 Lions RGA won last year, when he was also awarded the coveted Lion of St. Mark Lifetime Achievement Award. Greenberg extols the awards. By winning awards, you are proving to clients you are good. It's not that different from the movie business. The attraction for me of the rewards is to attract and retain talent. Amir Kasai, the chief creative officer at DDB Worldwide, disagrees. Although Kasai says his agency had won more Grand Prix Lions at Cannes than any agency, nevertheless he wrote in a 2016 newsletter that winning awards took too much time and money and did not prove the effectiveness of the advertising. He pledged that DDB would vie for fewer awards. Why? Because we believe that winning awards only means that you are good at winning awards. Because we care more about selling our clients than ourselves. Because we care more about emptying our clients' shelves than filling our own with trophies. Kasai's words are not matched by his agency's boasts. If one clicks on the DDB website, it touts the hundreds of creative awards won, including almost 100 Cannes Lions. strolling along the Croisette across from the Carlton on the way to the Palais, which houses multiple theaters where awards are presented most nights, and where a crowded program of daytime speeches and panels occur, and ad campaigns are displayed, one passes what Jeff Goodby has described as a strip mall of vendors. The festival calls this part of the Croisette, which overlooks the beach, Cabana Town. Along the way, one strolls past the buildings containing the IBM, Oracle, Adobe, Accenture, PricewaterhouseCoopers, McKinsey, and Deloitte cabanas, among others. On the sand below are the private beach spaces, Facebook Beach and Google Beach and YouTube Beach, each featuring exhibits and talks and free-flowing rosé. Walking past these consulting and tech company cabanas in Cannes is a reminder, if any is needed, that space at the marketing table is getting crowded. These companies have gobbled up ad and marketing agencies. In the 2 years before Cannes, IBM absorbed 31 marketing companies. Accenture bought 40, and Deloitte 26. Advertising Age has reported that 8 of the top 10 ad agencies are not traditional ad agencies, but consulting and tech companies. Looking back at Cannes is also a reminder of another marketing change. No, not Unilever's Keith Weed's chartreuse sports jacket, one of two gaudy green jackets he brings to Cannes every year. With the jackets and his thick head of blondish hair that flops over his forehead, he could pass for an aging British rocker. Weed's Wednesday keynote to an audience packed into the vast Grand Theatre Lumiere was billed as the future of brands. He made the case that to successfully engage with consumers in the future, brands must convey that they are a purpose-driven business. Weed and an increasing number of brand managers believe this is what younger generations expect. The way to win their trust is to demonstrate a social purpose. He displayed a number of film clips and Unilever commercials warning of climate dangers like deforestation, spoke of how their Ben & Jerry's brand promoted gay marriage, and showed a clip from a film Unilever made for a conference of world leaders that ended with their CEO, Paul Polman, declaring, "Help us by adding your voice in the battle for climate change." Weed has more power than most CMOs, for not only is Unilever the world's second largest advertiser, but his reach in the company extends from marketing to communications to the company's sustainability efforts. He cited a survey Unilever did of 1,000 ads, half of which portray women in a stereotypical way, and of how his Dove brand has long created campaigns to lift girls' self-esteem. He announced hashtag unstereotype, a global effort its 400 brands would undertake to erode female stereotypes. He concluded by asking, "Do people buy products because they are more socially and environmentally safe?" They did, he said, because more progressive advertising produces stronger consumer engagement. He cited a Unilever global survey comparing non-social ads in 2014 with social ads for the same brand in 2015. Products with social message ads grew 30% faster, he said. I think you could argue in the last few years, with all that's going on with technology, that consumers have been ahead of marketing. Now, marketing must be ahead of consumers. We can build our brands in whole new ways. This is the future of the brand. Close your eyes and listen to Keith Weed, and you hear Al Gore with a British accent. "We sold our salami brand because it was a product that would never have a positive story," he said one day in his London office. He spoke of making marketing noble again. When he assumed his current position and latched onto the sustainability issue, he said colleagues resisted, asking, "What does sustainability mean?" What it means, he said, is we need to produce as much food in the next 40 years as we produced in the last 8,000 years to feed everyone. We can do it by managing waste. If we continue to live like Europeans, we will need to produce enough food for 3 planets. And 5 planets if we live like the U.S. By 2050, there will be as much plastic in the sea as fish. He is appalled that, globally, 2.5 billion people have no access to a toilet. This motivates me. I tell my marketers they are coming to work to do good. But don't be fooled. Keith Weed is a businessman, not a do-gooder. We tell our marketers we are going to teach the world to wash their hands better. And if we do that, we'll sell more soap. If we get people to brush their teeth twice a day, it would have a major impact on cavities and their health. And it would sell more toothpaste and toothbrushes. What Keith Weed is promoting is not new to marketing. In a week-long class, he volunteers to teach at the festival for about 30 young marketers from around the world. Jim Stengel shared his Pampers story. The young marketers listened raptly as Stengel told of when